Welcome to the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. This is a weekly podcast that features yours truly. I'm the master of a thousand holds, Mike Quackenbush. And with me as ever is Clayton Morris. And we get together on this podcast to chitty-chat.
Chitty-chat-chat. Have you ever ridden on that railroad, the chitty-chat-chat railroad?
Nope.
Neither have I. How you doing, my friend?
I'm all right. I had a weekend on the road. And this afforded me two things. One, like a broken nose. And two, I got to watch an entire season of Homeland.
You did?
I did, yeah.
So, thoughts?
It was bloody. Well, it was bloody, and it hurts a lot. And my face is very swollen.
Now, your nose probably looks a lot like Claire Danes. Zing.
Yeah. Hey. So let's not bury the lead, and let's not spare the spare ribs. Homeland is very, very good, and it's very, very good for a number of reasons. One of them is this: I am not expected to think Claire Danes is attractive.
Right. Yeah. The whole season, she's like a little rough. Right. I mean, she's either beat up, half asleep, drugged up, drunk. In a hospital to have what was that one surgery at the end of the season?
They were going to give her shock therapy.
Shock therapy with her eyeballs going back in her head. You're not led to believe that she's stunningly attractive.
No. There are a few instances where they attempt to play upon that, but you never – in order for the series to work, you need not believe that she's sexy because she's not. She's not at all. If you put a meter of that close to her, the needle wouldn't move. The needle would just lie there. This to me is one of the chief errors of the series Sex and the City.
Right.
The conceit of which is that you must believe that someone wants to have sex with the four lead actresses. No one does. No one does. Who is it that Sarah Jessica Parker is married to?
Are they even married? I know that it's Matthew Broderick, right?
Right. At some point, he must have. But that's it.
Because they don't have any offspring.
Right. Yeah. You know, maybe like that after that first night, like he woke up and, you know, the champagne was out of his system and the wedding cake. And he was like, oh, I've made a terrible mistake.
Claire Danes, and she played Temple Grandin in that really good movie. You know, Temple Grandin is the autistic... autistic woman who became one of the top scientists in the world. And so she plays that, and she's not – I've met Temple Grandin. She's not an attractive woman. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't have the aversion that you do to Claire Danes, but I totally agree with you. They're not trying to make her out to be a beauty queen. And what I like about her in this show is – she's not trying to put on airs that she is any sort of beauty queen, right? She's like always rough. Her sister has to tell her to like put on a certain. You're gonna wear that. You're gonna put on those clothes. Even that spy who hangs out in her apartment to help her with the surveillance mocks her outfits, her clothes, her food in a refrigerator.
Yes. So the series to me, because obviously there are television series out there that really require you to believe that like the lead person. It was the same way. You remember when they introduced the character of Lumen into Dexter.
Right.
Right. Who's played by the awful, awful, awful Julia Stiles. The problem is you have to accept her as a replacement for the other character, Rita, in Dexter's life. Right. She becomes the new love interest.
Right.
And implausible. Implausible. Okay, Showtime executives. Luckily, as I said, that is not the conceit of this series. This series is, for all intents and purposes, to equate it to something, and I don't think that you would watch much of this. It is like Rubicon on AMC, except that it moves more quickly and it has more nudity.
Which, that's an A+ for you. Even without it moving quickly.
Right.
In fact, if you could have slow lovemaking, you'd be much happier. 20-minute lovemaking scenes. Give me that. Rubicon, where are you at, huh? Where are you at?
Rubicon's not moving that needle at all. It's very much like Rubicon. Barring the nudity and the difference in pacing. So I do like it. you know, it's a paranoid conspiracy-style psychological thriller, and it is based on, I believe, an Israeli series that translates to Prisoners of War, and that original series is now being shown on Hulu. So there are some pieces out there in the blogosphere that kind of compare the two, because even, you know, the creator of one is overseeing the other.
Right.
So they are very closely interwoven.
I think he's an executive producer, right?
Yeah, something like that. I think he wrote the pilot entirely as well. If you're interested, I should forewarn you, if you're thinking about going out and checking out the first 12 episodes, which comprise season one of the Showtime series Homeland, that the Prisoners of War, the original series on which it is based, and now both of these series, incidentally, are into their second seasons, and both of them have been picked up for a third season already by their respective home networks. Is that there are sort of three characters in Prisoners of War that are condensed into Sergeant Nicholas Brody. So some people I knew who had seen both were kind of saying to me, if you've seen the other one and you see what they've done to kind of like Americanize it for our audience, it's a little disappointing because there doesn't really seem to be this need to dumb something down like this. So I've been told you could watch the original and then watch the American version, but you can't watch the American version and then go back and watch the original because it ruins the experience.
Which is interesting. I mean, I get the – well, I mean, let's talk about the terrorism aspect of this, right? And I don't know to what extent the Israeli television show takes this on, but it makes sense that in the United States there's a prisoner of war – an American Marine who's trapped in Afghanistan, and it relates to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and whoever the new figurehead of the Taliban. I mean, that hits home, right? I mean, we can all relate to that because we have repeated arrests and lone wolf arrests who are very, very similar to this. This is like, you know, I know you like Law and Order. This is like ripped right from the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense in that regard. The Israeli setup, I'm not sure. Do you know like what the plot summary is on that show?
It's very much the same in that there were, there are three prisoners of war, and they were held in captivity for 17 years, as opposed to, you know, the Nicholas Brody character was held for 8. And then they are returned, and they return to their lives, which are, of course, in disarray. You know, one of them returns to a wife who'd been waiting faithfully for him. One of them returns to a wife who, believing he was dead, then married his brother. I think the other one returns home to find his whole family is dead or something like that. But the undercurrent of this is that why, if these men were unable to give up information that was of military benefit to their captors, why were they kept alive? And certainly that's kind of like the underlying thing in the American version in Homeland is why did they keep Brody alive for 8 years if he was of no use to them? And, the idea there, of course, is that he's been turned, that he's actually like a sleeper agent working for his captors now, which they swerve you on back and forth repeatedly throughout the first season.
Right.
They'll take you really hard in one direction. They'll lead you down this trail. Then they'll lead you right back to the opposite end. You know, at one point you're absolutely convinced that Claire Danes' character has got him nailed. And then, after like that sort of personal interrogation in the cabin, you get the sense that, wow, we just totally got this thing wrong. And then they swing you back again. And that's kind of the fun of it. To me, that recalls what I loved about Lost. In
right.
That they would kind of take a block of episodes where they really wanted you to buy into John Locke's rhetoric. And then they'd bring something in where Jack would just totally like controvert everything that he says, and then you're like, yeah, I'm back on the Jack bandwagon. And then before
and then
the
you're suddenly on
over,
Linus. You're like, well, now I'm a fan of Linus. Like, how'd that happen?
Right. Exactly. So I like that about it, that it never really rests into a pattern. Like some ongoing American television series, like this sort of set up the basic conceit of it, and these are the people you agree with, and these are the people you don't agree with, and the series never really fluctuates from that. Whereas, as the series is going on, at times you're kind of rooting for Claire Danes' character to succeed, and at other times you're hoping that she fails. And that's kind of true of the main plot movers. You had mentioned this upon bringing the series to my attention, and even mentioned it here on The Grizz, that perhaps the standout performer of the entire series is one of the most overlooked, and that's Mandy Patinkin.
Right.
Who plays the mentor character, Saul. And he's fantastic. Like, he is 100% believable. Whereas sometimes you're kind of like, that's just Claire Danes.
Right.
Or, you know, like you kind of watch the guy who has to play Nicholas Brody, who's like this incredibly convoluted and conflicted character. And sometimes he's excellent. And other times you're just like, huh?
Saul is always on point. He plays Saul, and who, you know, he has a big thick beard, and you know he's a grizzled veteran of the CIA, so much so that it costs him his marriage. As his wife repeatedly says, you know, you say you're going to be home. I would love for one night to go to sleep with you and then to wake up with you in bed in the morning. Mm-hmm. He's such a, you know, he's married to his work, and mm-hmm. and that comes through. You know, he sits in his office late at night eating crackers with peanut butter on them that he keeps in his drawer of his office because he's working so late into the evening. Mm-hmm. And he's incredibly believable. And of course he's a friend and a confidant of Claire Danes' character. He's a very paternalistic figure as well, right? Because he has to put the smack down on her after she kind of puts the moves on him at that one point.
Yeah.
He's just so offended by that.
Her character, Carrie Matheson, is the character that Claire Danes plays. You know, she comes from a family that has a history of bipolar disorder. And her father is kind of like a lost figure. You know, the few times that you see him, you know, about the only thing he can manage to do correctly is make a turkey sandwich. He can't even iron his own shirt without nearly setting the house on fire, you know. So Saul, played by Mandy Patinkin to great effect, really does. He takes over in that father role for her, and he's the father, he's the mentor, and he's incredibly effective. And you kind of get the feeling that he's made to be a background player, at least in the first half of the season. You know, that he's going to kind of be like Obi-Wan Kenobi. You'll get him in a couple choice scenes, but he's never really around. But then toward the end of the first season, he really gets a chance to shine, in particular in the episode where they intercept a fleeing suspect who crosses into Mexico, and Saul goes down personally to retrieve her and drive her the 30 hours back. And you kind of watch how across this car ride, you know, from, you know, the Mexican border back to Langley, I guess they're taking her in Virginia, how he just kind of works his magic. And that was great. Like, it was really fun to kind of see him get a chance to shine. And that I really feel like that whole episode was about him.
Right, and you get that. I think was that the beginning of the episode or towards the end of the episode when he picks up his wife at the airport or somewhere in there. I'm trying to remember, but and you're wondering like where has his wife been for so long? You know,
right?
She comes back into the fold, and you think life's going to get back to normal, and of course he's married to his work. I have to say another person who for whom I've been a fan for many years, and going back to the Band of Brothers series on HBO. Is Damian Lewis, who mm-hmm. plays Nicholas Brody, the Marine. And I didn't realize at the time, he played Sergeant Winters in Band of Brothers, which of course won all those Emmy Awards and is, you know, is worth repeated watching if you are a fan of history. So it follows the 101st Airborne Division as chronicled by Stephen Ambrose. Starts with their training down in Currahee in Georgia. I think in Georgia or is it North Carolina? I think, yeah, Georgia. And then from there to the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, and then through the entire European theater, through the Battle of the Bulge and everything else. But he plays Sergeant Winters, who for us, he lived right outside of Hershey, Pennsylvania. And one of the true war heroes of World War II. In fact, some of his like maneuvering was still studied at West Point. Some of the trench maneuvering that he did right after Normandy. Remarkable stuff. He plays this incredible American soldier, but he's British. Mm-hmm. And I'm just always struck by that. How do you pull that off? And so here again, Damian Lewis, born in London – in the early 70s, is playing an American Marine. And not a hint of British accent comes through at all during it. And I think does such a great job dealing with the sort of conflicted nature of his capture. And interestingly, I was reading about him a few weeks ago that he never auditioned for the role. That the series creators were so impressed with him in a little known film that he did called Keen, K-E-A-N-E. It was like wildly under-promoted, but they were so impressed with his performance in that that they just over the phone gave him the role, which I think is pretty remarkable. So he didn't even have to audition for it. And even as a British actor, he gets to – that just shows you the confidence that they had in him. Like, well, we got a British guy. Let's get him on the phone and we don't even need to audition him to see if he can pull this off. Do you know how many episodes deep they are in the second season yet? Because I want to start watching it because a cliffhanger is enough to make you go mad, you know?
It's like 5 or 6 deep. It looks like this. It'll wrap up right around Christmas time, the second season. And I don't know if they're available or not yet. I do want to point out that, most of the other TV shows I've ever had to buy through iTunes are like $1.99 an episode, and these are $2.99. I just want to throw that out there, iTunes. You know, I know a lot of celebrities listen to this program because of Clayton. You know, Clayton, who's on the Fox News Network, he's seen worldwide by millions and millions of people every weekend. We attract a lot of celebrity listeners, like Karl Rove, because of that. And first of all, let me just say this. Claire Danes, I don't know you. I'll never know you. I'm sure you're lovely in real life. This is just me reacting to the way you come across on my screen, and I don't want to see you there. I want to say that. I know all the up-and-ups at Apple listen to this because, you know, under the table, they pay Clayton large sums of money to trumpet their crappy products. I'm sorry if you're offended, but $2.99 an episode, I mean, come on.
But I warned you about this. Remember I said you got to hit the standard definition button? I think you bought it in HD. So if you hit the SD button, if you hit SD, it's $1.99.
Sigh. Anyway,
now whose fault is it?
So I really did like Homeland, though, and thank you for imposing it on me. And I'm interested
as I am wont to do.
I'm interested to see where it goes from here. I am very, very intrigued, and I was lucky. I was lucky that I had a lot of travel, and I just happened to be able to watch it.
Well, we should pause here and thank one of our show sponsors. On the back end, I'll tell you about a series I just finished on the plane ride out to where I currently am right now, which is in the great state of Hawaii. I'll tell you about Dexter, which I just wrapped up just a little bit because I know you haven't seen it yet. So,
no, I'm 2 seasons behind now on Dexter.
I think I might be too. What season are they on now?
7.
So I might – did I just finish – season 5 was with Jordan Chase?
5 is the one with Julia Stiles.
Okay. Then I just finished season 6, and I think they just started season 7. Yeah.
And that I don't know, but I know the Julia Stiles season's the last one I saw.
So season 6 I just wrapped up. We'll talk about that in a minute. But first, let's talk about our good friends over at Drobo, the makers of a whole new lineup of backup electronic devices to make your life incredibly easy. You know, they haven't refreshed the lineup in quite a few years. And so
if it ain't break, don't fix it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they were working on a whole new – some of the complaints that they had early on were like, hey, it's a little loud and it's a little slow. Well, you know, look, technology grows pretty quickly. And so what they did was they made all their new Drobos incredibly quiet and incredibly fast. And how does it work, basically? Well, you've got multiple hard drives in one sort of shell casing. And the reason I bring this up is because so many people don't back up. And the way that this works is if one of those drives fails – so let's say you've got 4 drives in there. If one of them fails, all of your data is safe across the other drives. I know it seems like magic, and it really is. It means the way that it's the best storage solution that you can go for. It's safe. It's expandable. So I remember when I first bought my Drobo, my 4-bay Drobo years ago, I think like hard drives, like, you know, like 500 gigabyte hard drives or 250 gigabyte hard drives in there. So for maybe a total of like a terabyte or maybe like 750. Now, you know, you can go on Amazon, you can order like 3 terabyte drives and even more than that and put them in there. So it's expandable. So it grows as the technology grows. It's powerful enough for business. It connects to your computer, to your home network. Mike, you're running a Drobo FS, so that's on your home network. So anyone in the family could access the Drobo FS and backup as well.
That's right. But I've actually been thinking about upgrading to the Drobo 5D. And I want to recommend this one to you, too, if you're not running it. And that's because this one's really kind of designed for guys like you and I that deal with tons of media, right? We've got video files we're constantly working with. We've got audio files we're working with. Clayton's really into photography. And, of course, you don't want to be saving the gorgeous photos you take at, like, 72 DPI, right? You're going to be storing huge, high-res versions of these photographs. You've got movies and photos of your kids. Original art, all that type of stuff. Well, for people that deal with lots of media, whether you're creating it, you're editing it, or you're just otherwise, man, you're like the multimedia watershed, I don't know. If you've got a lot of demanding media needs like that, you know how catastrophic it can be to have a drive fail and to lose all of your work. Well, the Drobo 5D is designed exactly with people like you and I in mind. It's incredibly fast. It's the highest performing personal storage array out there right now. And it's one of the newest. It's and among the latest and greatest from our friends over at Drobo. They've got a demo set up. You can read all about this and the whole line of Drobos when you visit them at their website. Drop over at Drobo.com and keep this in mind because it makes a great gift for the tech person in your life or even the non-tech person because we all need to back up our stuff.
Indeed, we do. It's got Thunderbolt connectivity now and USB 3.0 because that means it's super fast too when you connect it. If you're moving those big files back and forth, you don't have to worry about latency and waiting around for it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, on my flight out to Hawaii, I finished Dexter season 6, and you know, I was a little. It's hard to top Trinity. From season 4. John Lithgow as Trinity. Mm-hmm. And so I was, you know, I don't know that I was sucked into the season as quickly as I was sucked into the Trinity season. And for that matter, the Julia Stiles season was very good as well. Mm-hmm. But I think sort of the gold standard for seasons right now, you know, is Trinity. But this season really impressed me with the twists and turns that I certainly did not see coming. And there's certainly this massive sort of religious undertones of the whole season, right? He's grappling with a friend, this guy, Brother Sam, who may or may not be a bad guy. And then he realizes he's not, but he's, you know, he was sort of born again. And then so Dexter wonders if that's something that he could get into. And this season sees Colin Hanks, the son of Tom Hanks, as one of the cohorts, one of the presumed serial killers, along with Edward James Olmos, who plays sort of his mentor. So it's two of them as these serial killers. And you just don't know where it's going. And, of course, the end leaves this massive cliffhanger that I just cannot wait to see season 7. So having said that, I know you haven't seen it, so I won't ruin it for you. But it is one jaw-dropper of a season cliffhanger. And it just makes you just want to dive in and see season 7 right now. So you are two seasons behind?
Yeah, that's right. I haven't seen any of 6, and 7, I believe, is ongoing right now. So
yeah, so I'm curious to see how long they can keep this going. You know, it's
well, there
hard.
Is. There's only one more. They've all come out and said that it is designed to end with season 8.
Oh, good. I just was hoping that they wouldn't drag this thing out. You know, I mean, they've got – it's hard to keep coming up with unique serial killers every season.
Well, yeah.
You know, and it can just become a little trite. Really? There's that many serial killers living in Miami? Right?
It's like Gotham City. Like, man, there are a lot of gimmicky super criminals that all live here.
Right. Why this one city? You know, it seems like such a beach, nice beach town. Like, why? Why do they have these issues, you know? So, yeah, I'll be interested to see how they carry that thing through. I wanted to talk a little bit about this because – and I need your assistance. Your passive-aggressive assistance. To deal with a surly neighbor back home.
Oh.
Now, we are – I'll talk a little bit about Hawaii in a moment because, you know, as I want to do, we're at a Disney place right now out here in Hawaii at the Awalani Resort. Which is a Disney – just opened like a year and a half ago, and it is quite beautiful. And I'm just struck by – you and I have remarked about this before, but the level of detail that Disney pays attention to, No stone is left unturned for them. Mm-hmm. And what I love about Disney and the sort of the experience when you go on a trip is that they anticipate the things that you think you're going to need, right? Especially for parents. Like yesterday we rented a car. And they just take care of the fact that they know you're going to need multiple versions of a potential car seat.
Mm-hmm.
So that shouldn't be something left to chance, right? So they figure out, like, they already know, like, the age of your kids and what size car seats you're going to need. So when they pull up the rental car, like, there's the infant seat there, and then there's the larger 2-year-old car seat there. Everything is – the level of detail, the attention to detail is remarkable. Mm-hmm. And I'm always curious about the enthusiasm that every worker at Disney exhibits.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get that much enthusiasm?
Fear.
I guess, right? It's like, don't they say that? If you see them, or if they're caught like not smiling like 3 times, they lose their job. Exactly. I don't know if that's true
exactly.
or not.
Yes. Do you remember that was once confirmed to us by our high school era friend, Stacey Hager, from her time when she was working for Disney.
Hmm. I mean, everyone is just – and even the guests are nice.
Mm-hmm.
And – I was just thinking about this last night because we're dealing with this like surly neighbor back home,
mm-hmm.
And the sort of email chain that's been going around while we've been gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, God, this person's you know, just batty. This person's like mm-hmm. lacks any common sense and just like off the rocker, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Disney, at least at some of their parks and some of their different amenities, as you would call, maybe some of the resorts or maybe a cruise ship. I don't know. They manage to limit the amount of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
They do a great job of, I don't know, preemptively protecting their guests against crazy. Or as soon as they notice crazy, they swoop in to sort of stop it. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They kind of swoop
with tasers.
Right. Right. You don't see it. Like, I would imagine, like, if there's things going on in the background, you know, with they just kind of like there's somebody in a room somewhere that they can just radio and, you know, they just kind of swoop in and they take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, let me add something to that. I think people who have a penchant for displaying that, it is most likely to manifest itself when they are put under stress.
Right.
And the Disney people, of course, they are expert at making sure that people have as few stressful experiences as possible. Like you said, like with the car seat thing, that could be very stressful if someone shows up with your rental and they don't have a seat to accommodate your little one. That could be a very stressful situation. So I think, you know, their experiences lend themselves to less of that because they are so adept at addressing customer needs.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. Like, we arrive here, and they know that, look, you probably had a long flight. It's not easy to get to Hawaii, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you get here, you fly in, you're tired, you probably just want to get to the hotel, maybe throw your bags down, relax a little bit. And, you know, you arrive, they give you, like, whatever, the necklaces, you know, and they give you, like, you need some water? Here's a nice big glass of cold water for you. What's your name? Oh, yeah, we've already taken care of that for you. Like, they go to great lengths to make sure that they've already thought of the next step. When you're at the pool, you know, is there a restroom nearby? Is there a towel nearby? Is all of these little extra things taken care of where I don't have to worry about going and finding it?
Mm.
So last night we were dealing with this crazy neighbor back home who our one friend – we have these cats in the backyard,
mm-hmm.
these feral cats.
Mm.
They – when we moved in, they were like kittens, right? And I don't know where they came from. Probably someone like you who just had like a litter of them and put them out their back door. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not dealing with these.
Right. Yeah. Get out.
And so there are a bunch of them around the neighborhood, not just in our backyard, but down in the sort of joint backyards of a lot of our neighbors through like a block or two. Well, one of our neighbors sent out an email saying that she's tired of it. Could the folks who are continuing to feed the cats please stop? Because there's so much cat feces in her backyard that she doesn't want her kids to even go outside. And the cats are feral, which means they're dangerous and likely have rabies. And that's problematic. Would you let your son run around in the backyard like that?
Filled with feces? No. No, I mean, unless it was our feces.
Right. And so she, you know, sends this email. And you think, okay, yeah, everyone's going to be on board with that, right? Like, we're going to call animal control because that's their job. That's their job, right? To come in and get feral cats and feral dogs and maybe a squirrel's caught in your chimney or something. You know, I don't even know what animal control does, but it seems like Jim Carrey is at the head of it and he's involved somehow.
Right, yeah. That's the only thing I feel confident about is that it's led by Jim Carrey.
Right, as a pet detective. So you know, you think, okay, this is going to be resolved pretty quickly. She's letting people know that, you know, she's taking the appropriate steps. She's probably going to call animal control. If the folks who are repeatedly feeding the cats refuse to stop, like, hey, can we all agree, just stop feeding the cats and let them? I mean, after all, cats were fine without humans for a long time, right? They're hunters. They go after mice and moles and whatever they eat, right? But they're fine.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need cans of Starkist to survive.
I believe that to be true.
Natural selection would have eliminated them a long time ago if that's what they needed to survive.
Mm-hmm.
God, like, put an asterisk by cats and says, you know, like, they need Starkist to survive.
Mm-hmm. But I know where this is going already, because there are people who just, when it comes to anything with animals, man, they lose sight of their brains.
Exactly. And so most people are like, yeah, we're in agreement with you, and I'll withhold the name of our kind neighbor who's dealing with this issue. And, you know, furthermore, who had the wherewithal to put out the email chain to the neighborhood group? Because we haven't. We've just been lazy about it. You know, we'll see a cat pop up on our back porch, you know, and I get annoyed by it. And I'm out there mowing the lawn, and I'll step in cat poop, and I get annoyed by it. But then I forget, you know. But these cats are running around like crazy now, and they're just multiplying because this woman keeps feeding them.
Mm-hmm.
So people respond in kind, and they support her. Then this woman, this crazy woman, responds and starts to lay into the fact that this other woman is immoral for teaching her children that animals are like lesser creatures, and therefore she wants to hurt these animals, and what a terrible mother she must be. Mm-hmm. For wanting to keep the cats, her feral cats, away from her children.
Mm-hmm.
To which she responds, you know, I will always err on the side of the protection of my child over a cat.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a problem with that, you know, please take it up with someone else. Or you can email me separately and you can lay out your case separately, but get off this email chain.
Yeah.
That's the type of crazy that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That it seems to be minimized when you're like at a Disney place. It just doesn't thrive too well. Well, how would you handle this? So I'll tell you. I'm curious
so
how
get
you
the
would
neighbors
handle-
together and send her to Disney.
I'm curious how you would handle this, because I sent an email and I want to see if it's in. I want to see if it's in keeping with what you would have done. Because I told my wife when she was reading me this whole email chain. I said, forward it to me. I'm sending an email right now.
Yeah.
I want to see if it's similar to what you would have done.
Right, because I'm a good litmus test for that.
Right.
you know, recently I had complained aloud, and when I say aloud, I mean in a fake way, on Twitter, about a disturbing trend at my local Target. And I was actually contacted by people at Target in response to this, which is just smart customer service. Because they don't want me to continue to trumpet my displeasure with them in a public forum. They'd rather deal with me privately. And once we make that move, then it's like all kid gloves are off, right? Because I might temper what I'm saying for a larger audience, but if I have the responsible element held captive, I have their attention, I might be a little more severe.
Right.
So... You know, if I was going to address this crazy woman directly, I would probably be far more severe. And unfortunately, it's in those instances when typically you need to exhibit greater diplomacy. But that tends not to be my tact.
Right. Perhaps you're right about the litmus test.
Yeah.
So I just sent a simple email to the entire chain, and I just said, if a homeless man... I said, first of all, this is common sense, right? If a homeless man were crapping in your yard, and harassing your children, would you continue to feed him, or would you call police and try to get him to a shelter where he can have appropriate help and a hot meal and where he's not harassing your children? Right? That seems to me a similar approach to these cats, right? They're crapping all over the yard. They're harassing your children. Don't keep emboldening their behavior by feeding them cans of tuna. Seems like common sense to me. I mean, and I know it's an extreme example. I think I got my point across because I got a couple of she responded with another angry email. So I know I did my – she said, take me off this email chain. Good. I got my point across. I said, furthermore, I'm calling animal control because it's illegal to feed cats, wild cats. It's like a $2,000 fine. And that's what animal control does. They come around. They take them. They take them to shelters, and they do what they need to do. You're not helping anyone with crazy feral cats.
Right. No, I, you know, I think sometimes that's the best thing that you can do is just kind of you turn it over to some kind of governing body. And certainly here in the United States, there is an organization or other body that governs everything we do. And let them take it over, you know, like get that out of your hair as fast as you can. Right. I mean, that's why we are as heavily taxed as we are for just these situations. When the feral cats are crapping and harassing, we're like, thank you. Thank you, U.S. government, for taking all my tax dollars. Send in the troops.
And by the way, that it was one of my favorite Red Hot Chili Peppers albums. When the feral cats are crapping and harassing.
Right. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, it was a concept album of theirs, the Chili Peppers.
You have to really listen.
Figured some great bass work by Flea.
You really have to listen to that from beginning to end with headphones on. Really fantastic. By the way, did you see that little message I sent you about the pedal steel guitar?
Yeah, I could barely see it, like the way my phone sizes those pictures. It was literally like the size of my pinky nail. I did. And it's weird that you bring that up. And I want to mention this because I love to complain about Rolling Stone, the magazine Rolling Stone on here. As I have said more times than not, I find them to be purveyors of populist trash. And one of the things I dislike most about them is that it is maybe at most once or twice a year they ever write anything that I'm even remotely interested in. On the other end of the spectrum, and I don't know, I've gotten a number of kind of strange, unmarked gifts recently sent to my attention through Chikara, which is the wrestling organization that I call home. And I just wanted to express my thanks to whomever has sent the – and I don't think they're coming from the same person.
They're coming from inside your house.
Right. From someone in my attic. I'm not sure who sent it. Someone sent me a – first of all, I want to express my thanks. Whoever sent me this two-disc John Cortez compilation, which was unmarked. The only thing I know is it was delivered airmail because it was stamped as such and sent to my attention. I'm very, very thankful whoever took the time to put that together for me and send that to me. He's really one of the unsung heroes of British wrestling from the 1970s, and thank you for sending me that. And I also want to extend my thanks to whomever sent me what I believe now is last month's issue of a magazine called Uncut. Are you familiar with this?
Is that like Fangoria?
No. I'm pretty sure this is a British magazine.
Uncut. Is it like a film
99%. No, it is about music. And
Yeah, I have heard of this. Now that you bring it up, I have. And in fact, I think there I've seen a lot of people praising it. And I don't know if I'm wrong about that or not, but I've seen a lot of people saying great things about it. And I think they have an iPad app. That within the app you can play music, like, you know, you just tap, like you buy the issue on your iPad, and embedded in the issue, of course, because it's an iPad, you can play music, right? So something that a paper magazine can't do unless they had like a big disc in the back or one of those birthday cards that you open and it sings to you.
Well, this one does come with a CD, which I'm very excited to listen to. And I just want to, from the table of contents here, give you a sense of what the magazine contains. This has the it boasts, so this is why I think it's a, you know, like last month's issue or whatever. The first review of the brand new Bob Dylan album. It has a feature on, I'm assuming this is a band called Grizzly Bear, which I didn't know was a thing. Also features on Frank Zappa, The Grateful Dead, Robert Plant, interview with David Byrne and St. Vincent, plus an audience with Michael Nesmith.
Wow. Really?
the Nesmith and David Byrne pieces are even back to back. Like they're, I finished reading one, turned it over, and then the next page was a huge photo of David Byrne. Incredibly rare that those two men would appear in the same magazine. I mean,
at most in a Rolling Stone issue, you'd get like a little square and have like a picture of Nesmith, like with like a little blurb that he's at a charity event.
Right. But not even, I mean, really until the death of Davy Jones, it was like, you know, those guys didn't exist. And they were, you know, famously the editors at Rolling Stone have been notoriously anti-monkeys for decades. They have always gone out of their way to like never give them any credit for anything that they've done collectively or in their solo careers. So I'm very grateful whomever again sent this to me. Thank you for sending it to me. And what I've read of it thus far, it's been outstanding. So I wanted to mention that because this seems like a welcome alternative to things like Rolling Stone, and it really discusses the kind of stuff that I would want to read, you know, those interviews, the Bob Dylan review, and I'm more likely then to, you know, take a positive recommendation from a magazine like this, which seems to share my personal aesthetic, than I would be like when I see a positive, you know, I don't know what they give them, 4 or 5 stars in Rolling Stone, and think, oh, I should, you know, Rolling Stone says that, I should go out. No, because everything else Rolling Stone writes, I completely disagree with. So, yeah, I just wanted to take the opportunity to say thank you to the people that are sending that stuff to me. It's very, very generous and gracious of you, and I've in particularly enjoyed this recent stuff that's shown up.
I just checked in the newsstand on the iPad, so you have to go through the newsstand section. It's not in the App Store, although it may. If you just go do a search there, it probably does. But Uncut Magazine is available there. They've got a North American version of it. And so Uncut is the essential magazine about rock music, written by the people who love that music as much as you do. Every month it features the most comprehensive and trustworthy album reviews section in the world. There are in-depth interviews with the finest musicians of the past 5 decades, exciting new artists, insightful, informative, passionate about extraordinary music. That's Uncut. Mm-hmm. You can buy subscriptions for a year or per month. Monthly subscription is $5.99. Or an annual is $59.99. And it's available on newsstand. Also, I think at the Google Play Store for your Android device as well. Cool. So I imagine you can tap on it and listen to music samples and so forth. And it looks like they have a really cool feature piece about Paul McCartney in this issue that they're featuring here. Like his sort of his solo work and some of the stuff that he was dealing with while working on a solo career and stuff, which looks really cool.
Yeah, they had part of what made me, that trigger in my brain was that you brought up the pedal steel, and they have like a recurring feature in Uncut Magazine that talks about pedal steel players. And in this one, they happen to be focusing on the guy that plays the electric Hawaiian pedal steel guitar on Elton John's Tiny Dancer album. He was the same guy who arranged strings on Automatic for the People, which I didn't know.
Wow.
So, you know, lots of just in the few pages I was able to, you know, I kind of skipped particularly to the stuff that interested me most immediately. But, yeah, just it seems like it's really well done and put together and right up our alley. So I wanted to give those guys a plug. And who knows, it may have even been somebody there who's heard what we talk about on this very podcast that chose this one, given the feature on Grizzly Bear and sent that along. So, yeah, cool. Uncut Magazine. Check it out online and obviously in print as well.
Yeah, so what I had sent you with the pedal steel guitar stuff, I was listening on Songza. You know, I'm out here and was relaxing a little bit and wanted some music while I was sitting by the pool, so I put on my iPhone, flipped on the Songza app, and just did a search for genre of Hawaiian music and found a couple of different categories of Hawaiian music. But the first one that jumped out to me, and I didn't realize, like, the pedal steel influence in Hawaiian music. Certainly, maybe the backbone of Hawaiian music really is the pedal steel guitar, and it didn't occur to me. I just thought maybe the guitar, the ukulele, perhaps, but certainly the, you know, classic first recordings of Hawaiian music all had this really pronounced pedal steel guitar. And you and I have an affinity, I think, for the pedal steel guitar, not only, you know, for some of the rockabilly music that I like, but also because of Red Rhodes from Mike Nesmith and the First National Band. Days. Was he with him just – he was with him for a few albums even after the First National Band, right?
Yeah, he was with him from the First National Band when he went solo all the way through Tropical Campfires. Rhodes was the longest, you know, kind of bandmate of his. He was with him in the Second National Band. They did Ranch Stash together. He's the only other artist on, and his just keep on coming. That's just Nez and Rhodes all the way through Tropical Campfires. And then shortly after he did the tour that culminated in the Live at the Brit Fest, just shortly thereafter, Rhodes passed away. I think before The Garden was released, he passed away.
So really a magnificent musician. And so I found this playlist of Hawaiian pedal steel guitar and put it on. And it was just it's that tinny, fabulous music that you could picture, you know, sitting in a I don't know, almost like in a darkened hut by the water, sipping some sort of a cocktail at night with just like a candle flickering in the beach and listening to this like tinny, almost like World War II era sounding music, just fantastic. And you know, some of the stuff's from the 1920s and 1930s. So if you into songs and you want something to put on in the background that's just going to like sort of take you away, especially given all the snow and wet slush we're seeing now back east, put on some of this. It'll just sort of take you away. It's the Hawaiian pedal steel guitar. I think it's like 50 songs, and I want to know who the heck curated that. There's some classic stuff on there. And I was going through and giving it like thumbs up. You know, on the app, you can just give it like thumbs up so it'll sort of tag it and find more of that stuff for you. So I was doing that because I was like, oh, I'd love to buy some of this stuff. This is really great stuff. Check it out.
Yes, indeed. Hey, I want to take a brief moment here to thank our other great show sponsor before the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe continues. I want to tell you a little bit about, and this is another one, you got to write this down, you're making up those holiday shopping lists, it's inevitable now that they put the Christmas trees up at Starbucks.
Right.
It's November. I'm talking about Cobra Electronics. Now, you've heard us talk endlessly about the Cobra Tag two-way locator system, which remains perhaps the most ideal stocking stuffer for someone who ever misplaces an item. You know, the Cobra iRadar system was an award-winning system that they still make available, and now they've even reduced the price even further because they've rolled out the latest and greatest. It's their ultimate detection system. Cobra has released, just in time for the holidays, the Vedetta system. It set a brand new standard at the highest end of radar and laser detection. This thing comes with a color LCD display so you can mount it anywhere on your windshield or dashboard and see exactly what's going on. It delivers unparalleled performance. It's got great range. It comes with an integrated GPS receiver. And of course, like the iRadar system did, it comes with lifetime access to the ARA driving hazard database. This is a national database of speed trap locations and other driving hazards that gets verified and re-verified twice a day. It's also a very smart system because as people are inputting new hazards that they've come across, the system updates itself, so you're always getting current, up-to-date information delivered to you in real time. These types of things like the Vedetta series, which is brand new from our friends at Cobra, or the iRadar, which I use when I'm road tripping, are great. They're especially great for people that road trip by themselves because it's like having somebody in the car yelling at you all the time. Just turn the volume up. It sounds like it's yelling. See? That makes you a safer and more alert driver. If you want something on the cutting edge, you need to go over. Just watch the little demo video they've put together on Cobra.com for the Vedetta series. If you're thinking about giving somebody the Tag or the iRadar or any one of the dozens and dozens of other tremendous innovations from Cobra Electronics, make sure you stick your head in that specials section on the left-hand side of their navigation because they're changing the deals up now every 7 to 10 days in there. You might find something that's buy one, get one free so you can keep one for yourself. You might find something over there that's on deep discount before. Some items have been discounted up to $80 off what the list price was, and they haven't even gotten to their Black Friday discounts yet. So go over and check them out and make sure to look in that special section all the time, which is constantly refreshed with new and awesome deals, not just for you, but for the gadget lover on your holiday shopping list.
Thanks, Cobra. And yesterday we did a little road trip here. We went out to the North Shore of Hawaii, and I wish I had the Cobra in the car. A lot of cops out there. I'm surprised by you do a lot of traveling, a lot more than I do. Have you ever been to Oahu?
Nope, I've never been to Hawaii.
You know, which is the most populous island, Oahu, which has the city of Honolulu and the beaches of Waikiki I have not seen Waikiki yet, and I'm not near there, but it's, you know, like a 45-minute drive or so. And then, of course, Pearl Harbor is here as well.
I've heard of that.
And, you know, you drive to the North Shore. That's, I guess, where a lot of the big surfing championships and contests take place because the waves there are very large. But there's some great food up in that neck of the woods. And so we drove up there, and boy, you know, there's a lot of cops on the road here, but there's a lot of traffic. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's sort of my East Coast mentality. You know, growing up in Reading, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia, you kind of get the sense of that's your world, right? That's how you see the world. And it's just hard for me to picture that there's a large city on this island. Mm-hmm. And when you glance down at like Honolulu, you're like, God, there's tons of huge buildings down there. Mm-hmm. Looks like it's like five times the size of Reading, Pennsylvania, you know, just massive. And the driver, you know, we were in the cab on the way here. He was like, you know, yeah, on the weekdays, you know, during rush hour, it's, you know, just bumper to bumper. And I'm thinking, really? On this island, it's really that? You just would think everyone should be hanging out by the beach.
Right. You know, no one works in Hawaii.
Right. But no, sure enough, they do. And if you've seen the movie The Descendants, which is a pretty good movie, that George Clooney film, you know, they live in Honolulu. And it takes place, it's set, you know, in the city. And he works downtown and, you know, he's in a normal office building. And it's just, you know, just kind of interesting. And I'm just struck by it. I keep remarking to my wife, like every day, I'm just like, well, I wonder what it would be like to live here. Because, you know, they talk about this thing, island fever. And I know that Matthew Fox talked about it when he was shooting Lost, that he and his wife, that you'd have to leave the island after, if you're here for like a month or two, you have to get off the island. Because you start to go a little nuts. And I'm just wondering why and how. Like, I think to myself, like, I'd like to test that and see if I would go nuts. like, what about the mainland is any more attractive than being here? Like, do I need to go to a Target? Like, what do I need back there?
Wait a minute. There's no Target in Hawaii?
I'm sure there is. And they have everything here. You know, we drove past a Lowe's, or McDonald's, Taco Bell. Like, everything you can think of is here. It's just obviously more expensive, right? Because 80% of the foodstuffs are imported to the islands. So that's why things like milk are more expensive and that sort of stuff. But we drove up to the Dole Plantation yesterday and did a tour, the pineapple fields. That was pretty remarkable. But I don't know. Because I feel like I'm such a homebody anyway. And I just need a good cup of coffee, and I need a good internet connection, and that's really all I need, right? That's all I need, and then I need my family. And other than that, like, I don't know what you would need about back on the mainland that you'd go nuts about being here. Can you think of it? I mean, I just don't understand. Maybe it's just that sense of space. I don't know.
Yeah.
But apparently it's a pretty common
thing. I've never been
there.
It's difficult for me to wrap my brain around that.
I know they've said that about Key West. I had a friend who, I don't know if I've told the story or not. I think it's fascinating, though. He's in radio, and he's from Missouri. He had applied, though, for a job in Key West on a radio show that they were hiring for. And they going through the interview process, and really, unless you're from the Keys, like, you will not get a job on the radio in the Keys. And he's like, they were telling him that you'll get island fever. And he's like, no, I can handle it. And they said, no, you can't. Trust us. We can't hire you unless you're from Key Largo or one of the upper Keys, like, or, you know, even Miami maybe, but where you could, like, go see family or something. But if you're not from the islands and you're spending a large amount of time on the islands, you will get island fever and you go a little nutty. I think it would probably be more pronounced in the Keys when you have islands that are only like a mile wide. But here, you've got this massive size island. There's a million people that live here. I just don't know how you would, but Matthew Fox was talking about how the cast of Lost would have to get off the island regularly or you go a little mad.
This is beyond me.
Yeah. Don't let it be.
I wish I had some input there. Yeah, I don't understand the phenomenon. If you want to get, like, the government to sponsor a test, you know, I'll do that.
Right.
I'll try to get the island fever.
I'll see if I can swing that. Get a grant.
Right.
You know how they
can you get, does Karl Rove have the power to make that happen?
Do you know how they talk about different ridiculous grants that the government funds?
Oh yeah, yeah, I do.
Like with the, like the, I don't know if you saw like the shrimp on a treadmill, where they were like studying to see if like shrimp would lose weight if they're on an underwater treadmill. Now, this is real stuff. Maybe we can do that. Maybe we can find out if there's like a government grant to test island fever, and you and I can be the guinea pigs for 2 years.
And if they want, like, I'll train shrimp to jog while I'm here. You know, I
you could kill two birds with one stone, which is right, also another grant.
Right, yeah. We get three for the price of one.
Can you kill two birds with one stone? That's part of the government grant program.
Right. Well, I'll do that when the shrimp are tired.
Oh, man. Anyway. Anything else? There were some things I saw. I don't know if we wanted to chat about them or not.
You saw? Run. You saw some things?
I saw some things. I saw some superhero-related stuff.
Oh?
You know, questioning, well, superhero and Star Wars and Star Trek, they're wondering whether or not J.J. Abrams would direct one of the new Star Wars films.
I did see that rumor going around.
Could he go from Star Trek to Star Wars? I think that might be muddy in the waters a little bit, because, you know, those two camps can be fiercely combative.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I do prefer my Star Wars by leaps and bounds to my Star Trek. So I understand that.
Transformers 4.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've been waiting for this.
Oh, my God, yes. Absolutely. Well, it's going to take place quite a bit after 3, they're saying.
Yeah, and now they're casting Mark Wahlberg in it.
I heard that.
Which, why would he do that? Like, he takes himself seriously as an actor. Why would he want to be involved with this? I guess I've heard it said that George, like the way George Clooney put it, which is like you've got to do a few of the Transformers movies to get to do some of the movies like The Descendants, right? Mm-hmm. You've got to do some of the Ocean's 11 so that you can do the Syrianas.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the way he sees it also.
Yeah. You know, go collect your big payday and then go do your, you know, smaller artsier films or whatever. I can totally see that. But yeah, I did see that Mark Wahlberg was going to be in it. And I don't know that I even finished the third Transformers movie. But this one is supposed to take place a handful of years after that. And apparently they're going to, like, there'll be different Transformers in it. It's not going to be the same exact ones. You know, you're probably going to get this, you know, there's no getting around like Optimus and Bumblebee and that sort of thing. But there's supposed to be some new ones in it.
And what else?
It's hard to care, though. It's hard to care because these are not the Transformers we grew up loving.
How far into that movie did you make it? Because I was testing a Google Nexus 7 tablet, and it came preloaded from the Google Play Store. It had Star Wars Dark of the Moon on there. Mm. And I watched... You know, you mean
Transformers Dark of the Moon, right?
What did I say?
Star Wars.
Oh, sorry. Don't want to mix those two up. So I watched the first... I watched like the first, I don't know, 20 minutes of it or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it was okay. Like they had the... like the thing on the moon where they're telling... Like they're like retelling the whole history of... The like the moon landing and the moon, you know, going to the moon in like five to 6 minutes or so.
Yeah.
It's pretty worthless. Did you see, though, that like that weird digital manipulation of John F. Kennedy in it?
Boy. I really don't remember. It was one of those, like, I was flying home from somewhere. I was watching it on a tiny screen. And then even as I was watching it, I was like, isn't there like a Madea film I could be watching? Like Madea meets Ernest at camp or something like that.
That would be a good one.
Yeah. No, I have vague recollections. I just kind of remember watching it through gritted teeth, and I think, you know, that's the one where at the end, like, the bigger, you know, whatever, takes a prime to kill a prime or whatever. I was like, forget this. So, yeah, like, the fact that they're doing a fourth one is kind of like, who cares? It's tough to get excited about that. You've seen what he does at the helm of that. You know, it's extremely unlikely, given that those movies do monstrous box office, that anyone's going to tell Michael Bay to try and do it differently. And it's equally unlikely that he'd listen.
Right.
So,
Yeah, and see how many kids at, you know, on Halloween were wearing like the Bumblebee outfits.
Yeah, and they are ugly. Oh, those costumes are ugly.
Yeah. What if your son ever said to you, "Dad, I want to be Bumblebee for Halloween"? What would you say?
He wouldn't. He wouldn't say that. He doesn't. The only Transformer he knows by name is Optimus Prime.
And, do you show him the old cartoons? Are they beyond?
Well, you know, my son does like the music of Stan Bush, and you know, his two most famous songs, "The Touch" and "Dare," are both in the '86 animated Transformers movie. So the parts that have those songs in them, we've watched.
Hmm.
So he has seen them. He has seen that. And, like, he's aware. Like, anytime he sees something, you know, that looks like it's a robot that turns into something else, he calls it a Transformer, even though, you know, that's not a unique concept to the Transformers franchise. So he has an understanding of what they are.
Yeah. All right.
I would say, though, based on, you know, my own surveying of things at Halloween, Spider-Man remains number one with a bullet. I saw more Spider-Man than anything else.
One family we met here said that their kids did they, like, I think they have three kids, three boys, but the family together went out and they did the Avengers.
Mm.
I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that is kind of cool. I saw a whole family of Power Rangers came around trick-or-treating, which I thought was very dedicated.
Are they still popular, Power Rangers?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, that whole regime, they're called Super Sentai. The Sentai soldiers over in Japan are kind of like one of the top three enduring Japanese superheroes, along with Ultraman and the Kamen Rider. And they've existed, I want to say, since maybe 1974 over there. And we adapted this here in the U.S. You know, they were kind of brought here. The name of the group escapes me. Do you remember this? Who? Saban, right?
Yeah.
Saban Entertainment are the ones that brought it to the U.S. The Japanese version of the Super Sentai is, like, at the end of every series or season, they introduce, like, the new team. And they used to for a while. I don't know if they still do this. They would make a movie in the gap between the seasons that would be released to theaters in Japan, where, like, the new team, it seemed like the plot was always the same in these movies. They'd fight, but then they'd team up against a greater evil, and, like, the older guys would either get killed off or they'd be retired, and the new team would take over, which is, you know, why, like, you know, it was Power Rangers Dino Force, and then it's Power Rangers Super Samurai, and then it's Power Rangers, you know, Hurricane Chasers, or, you know, whatever the next incarnation is. That's always kind of been it. That succession of the Sentai teams has gone on, and it's still, you know, it's still popular in Japan. And like I said, it's got to have been going on now for, I don't know, 30, 40 years.
Hmm. Remember watching those before school along with Jem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right when we got that here, she's truly outrageous, Jem. We used to, admittedly, not only did we watch Power Rangers, sometimes we would watch Barney, you and I.
Why are you admitting this?
Do you remember? It was very funny to us. There was something about Barney and Power Rangers. Like, we didn't watch them, you know, for the pure enjoyment of it. We thought there was something very funny about it. And I just remember, like, we would laugh and laugh watching these shows in the morning. I don't know if it was because we thought they were dumb or what it was, but something about it was very, very funny to us.
It really was. It was just, I couldn't understand how kids could be into it.
Right. It seemed so dumbed down. You just thought, who could possibly take this at face value?
Hopefully our kids will never be into Barney. We have a rule that's just not going to happen in our house. So as long as we can insulate our son from that.
Protect him against Barney.
Right.
There are far more evil things in the world than Barney, but
I don't know. I really don't know. I really don't think so.
You think that's it?
Feral cats.
Like, when it all goes down, like, whenever, you know, they find the hidey hole cave where the rest of Al Qaeda's hiding, like, Barney's in there.
You know? I think you're right. Which is also a good place to end the show on, I think. What's your schedule like this week?
Well, thanks for asking. You know, this Saturday I'm at Wrestling is Fun in Allentown, Pennsylvania. You can come and see me live, or you could watch it live as it's going to be streamed out totally free. The entire event as a test of a new system of streaming technology through SMVOD, like Smart Mark Video On Demand. www.theweekendshow.com. We'll stream this event out live on Saturday night, November 17th, from the West End Youth Center in Allentown, PA. So watch it from the comfort of your computer or otherwise mobile device. I know they're working hard to get this available through Xbox. Somehow you can watch it on your Xbox. I don't know. I guess you like open the lid where the disc goes and a hologram appears there. Somehow that'll happen. And then I'm most likely going to be up in New York City, although I don't have a match scheduled. I need to be on hand because sometimes I'm behind the microphone at Chikara events calling the action for you. And I always look forward to those occasions when I get to do play-by-play. The Cybernetico rises at 1 p.m. on Sunday the 18th in New York City. And there are only very, very few tickets remaining in the Highline Ballroom for this. We just had a standing room only crowd in Chicago this past weekend. Every chair was filled when we were in Columbus, Ohio, or not Columbus, we were in Cleveland, Ohio on Sunday. I got my C towns mixed up. Yeah, there's something like, I think, less than 30 seats through, and you have to get them through Ticketweb, that Ticketmaster subsidiary. There are none left available directly through Chikara. So if you want to come see me in New York City and the whole Chikara gang for the 9th annual Cybernetico, which features Team Kevin Steen against Team Eddie Kingston, plus the 123 Kid and Marty Jannetty against the Heartthrobs on the undercard, you got to get your tickets now, because chances are by the time you get to the door on Sunday, they'll be gone.
Good to hear, and I'll be back in the lower 48 states this week, getting ready to go back on the air post-craziness from the election. And we'll be
and
back
who
here.
Who won, Clayton? Who ended up winning this year? Warren Camp, right?
We all did.
We all did?
America won.
Oh. I'm relieved to hear that.
Yeah. Gary Johnson won. He was the independent candidate. He was the libertarian candidate. Yeah, I don't know who won.
Well, good for him. I saw somebody wearing a Ron Paul shirt over the weekend, and I thought maybe they're still counting the votes. Like, maybe he's still in the running.
Oh, those Ron Paul shirts. I bet you can put those up on eBay. Probably get a good, pretty penny for that. Mm. You could put up your Ross Perot shirt up on eBay.
Mm, I was a Ross Perot supporter. I'm not going to front about that. I was behind Ross Perot. Is he still alive?
Yeah, I think he is. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask him for some money. Well, yeah, so that's going to do it for the Grizzly Berry Cafe. Our schedule is beginning to resume now. I know some of you missed us. I saw your tweets if you missed Daddy on Board of the Trending Show. Sometimes when there's a fifth week in the month, you know that's bound to happen. But anyway, things will be back to normal here at the Grizzly Productions Network. And yeah, we'll be back in about a week. Upcoming, really, we promise, now that all the weather craziness is over, We will convince Glenn Phillips to do this interview that we've had to postpone with him like three times now.
Yeah, we had craziness and Hurricane Sandy and everything else got in the way. So that is upcoming here on The Grizz. Anyway, we'll see you again next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. See you, my friend.
Bye.